If you enjoyed this program, please sign up for our podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com.
Stories we like to tell is like when getting up early in the morning with our dad, we used to go out and meet up with our uncles and work in the fields.
He was always into the winemaking side, but just did homemade stuff. But everyone loved it.
As members of the family, presenting the wines ourselves, it's very important for us. And I think it's important for people as well to put a face on the wine.
I was born and raised here. I love the family history. I love the seasons. So somewhere deep down, I knew I was coming back.
It evolved. It started with wanting to grow grapes.
We say, so drink the wine. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 392. This week we feature Drew Nenow, winemaker and co-owner of Nenow Family Winery in Paso Robles, California. The wine industry celebrates the fact that so many owners are family. Who knows, maybe it's in their blood. Brothers, sisters, aunts, and uncles are all part of Drew Nenow's story. Nenow Family Winery can be found in Paso Robles, California, but their wines may be just a bit harder to find. Small production wineries are our favorites, especially when you think of the dedication to detail family members give the grapes. We spoke with Drew just last week to learn about the Nenow brand and why family is so important to him. You can also hear Drew on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the term oak integration. Well, continuing with our phone interviews for the podcast, we are talking to Drew Nenow, a co-owner and winemaker for Nenow Family Wines. How you doing, Drew?
Doing great. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being available to us during this whole period of COVID, and this will air in a couple of weeks, so we don't know how much things will change when this runs, but we've gone to phone interviews versus in person, and in person is so much more fun, so I'm hoping down the road somewhere along the line we'll get to meet.
Oh, me too.
Well, let's go ahead and kind of start right at the beginning for you. You're the winemaker, you're co-owner. You sound like a young guy to me. You already said that when we were talking about telephones versus landlines, that kind of thing. What about your start? How did you end up being an owner of a winery as well as a winemaker?
Well, it's definitely a history of privilege that I'm very aware of and thankful for. I don't think a lot of people can say that their wine experience started at the age of 8, but I do get to say that, and I'm extremely thankful for it. My aunt and uncle, Lisa Drinkwood and Les Behrens, started a winery on Spring Mountain in St. Helena in the early 90s. And so I say 8 years old because that's the first time I really have a memory of going up there and spending some time in their caves and their winery, and just for the first time getting a sense of what the work they do is like. And we probably made upwards of 6 to 7 trips up there a year as they were building up this winery. My dad was actively involved, would go up there in the fall and help them out with their winemaking. And, you know, sometimes all you just need are bodies during harvest to sort, and you don't necessarily need someone who knows a whole lot. Because for that part, my father was a computer technician for IBM since his early 20s. So he got the wine bug later in life and started helping them out with harvest. And then him and I both were taking trips up there and seeing my aunt and uncle do what they do and build up this winery that eventually was receiving nearly 100-point scores from Robert Parker. And during the cult wine boom of the late 90s and early 2000s in Napa Valley. And it was just a really exciting time. And I think what was most impressionable about that time for me was Lisa and Les were working so hard and really cutting their teeth in the industry. And I just, for a young person to watch someone work that hard, but be walking away from work with smiles on their faces and, you know, getting home and opening wine and talking more about wine. You know, I was used to, I have parents who both work trade jobs, and when they came home, they didn't want to talk about work at all. So for that time in my life to see people who were doing truly what they loved, my first recorded documentation of wanting to do wine as a career was when I was in eighth grade. A teacher had us write a time capsule letter to ourselves, and I still have this letter to this day that I wanted to study winemaking at UC Davis and be a winemaker. So that decision was made at the age of 13, and now at the age of 29, I've been able to see that to fruition. So that's how I got into it.
That's really nice. What a great story. Not too many people can say that they have that vision at a very young age. So good for you.
Thank you.
What's the name of your aunt and uncle's winery?
It was originally a cooperative effort with a man named Bob Hitchcock, and the label name was Berenson Hitchcock. Later, as they veered off from Bob Hitchcock, it now to this day is called Berens Family Winery.
Sure. I'm familiar with them. Interesting.
Yes. My uncle's name is Les Berens. My aunt, who is my mother's sister, is Lisa Drinkward. So they cooperatively run Berens Family Winery. And then my aunt has a label that she does with Francoise Pichon called Drinkward Pichon.
That is a damn fine wine. Oh, I got one last bottle in my cellar.
And Lisa would be the first person to tell you that she's privileged to work with someone like Francoise, because she is an extremely talented winemaker.
So you had wine in the family. It was really already in your blood, wasn't it?
Yeah. I don't think it was very missed on me when I was younger, the kind of wine that was on our table. It wasn't until later, I think probably when I was in college, where I really understood the gravity of the wines that were on our table growing up.
Yeah, that's funny. Hard to appreciate it when you're just a kid, right?
Yes. It's wasted on the youth.
Yes. I've heard that somewhere before.
Yep.
Now, you guys are located in Paso Robles, right?
Correct.
A tremendous wine area. And let's talk a little bit about your climate there for our listeners, just so they get an idea. Obviously, this is south of San Jose. Not too far, though, right?
No, it's about a three-hour drive from the Bay Area. And I think topographically, the best marker of what influences our climate and our terroir are the Santa Lucia mountain range. This is a mountain range that makes up what everybody knows as Big Sur, goes through Monterey County and then ends up in San Luis Obispo County, which is, you know, North County. San Luis Obispo County is where Paso Robles is located. And from there, I think the best way to get a sense of the terroir of the region is if you're driving the Highway 1 out of San Luis Obispo headed north, you hit the coastline in Morro Bay and you look north and there's just these rising mountains almost coming out of the ocean. Mm. And then if you drive through those mountains and onto the other side, you're in this incredible wine region that is somewhat high elevation, but has this, and it's a warm, warm climate, but it's got this maritime influence from being so close to the ocean. So you get this immense amount of ripening potential from the climate with a cooling effect of the ocean. And then you add in some really interesting and diverse microclimates and soil profiles throughout the west side of Paso, which is primarily where we source our fruit from, is the west side of Paso, that just create some next level world-class wines.
Now, do you guys have any of your own vineyards, or are you strictly doing sourcing?
Strictly doing sourcing. I actually hold the title winemaker for Nenow Family Wines, as well as another winery here in town called Onyx Wines. And Onyx is all estate-grown sourced fruit. And when it came to Nenow Family Wines, it was seeking out and finding the best vineyards that we possibly could for Rhone varieties in the area. And much like in watching my aunt and uncle source fruit through their career, it was a comfort. So to have that mobility and be constantly seeking out new and interesting terroirs and vineyard sites and aspects, it really resonated with us and something that we wanted.
Yeah, you can really kind of get the best of the best, can't you?
If you know the right people.
Yeah, yes. Oh, that's an entirely different story unto itself, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Obviously, you're doing primarily Rhone varietals. From what I've seen, very limited production, which is always sought out by wine lovers. Tell us about the wines you're making.
So when it came to the concept of when my sister, I guess I didn't really explain us as a company. It's a cooperative effort between myself, my wife, Andy, my sister, Tracy, and my brother-in-law, Mike. And it was Mike and Tracy who approached me with this idea back in 2014 of starting a winery. And it didn't get started until 2017. So in that time from 14 to 17, I really took a look at what I felt expressed itself, not only from a varietal standpoint, but expressed the terroir of not just Paso, but the Central Coast in general, the best. And unilaterally, whenever I tasted Syrahs, Grenaches, Mourvèdres, GSM blends, those were the ones that site-specific, more so than other varieties, really exuded the climate and the place that they were grown, which is by far my favorite aspect of making wine, is getting great grapes with from great terroirs and then basically in the winery, not screwing it up. A winemaker in this area by the name of Mark Goldberg, who is known for making Pinot Noir in the area of all things. I was at an event with him once and asked him what his one piece of advice would be. And he, I'm using a different word than he did. But he said, get good grapes and don't screw it up.
Yeah, there you go. Kind of like don't crash the ambulance.
Yeah.
And I saw you do a Bienesito, which was kind of cool. Mm-hmm. Very cool. I'm smiling right now.
Yeah, for those of you listeners who aren't familiar with Bienesito Vineyard, it's I guess if you could have a list of first growth game players on the Central Coast and California in general is, you know, the predominant best vineyards in California, Bienesito has to be on that list. It's been mentioned in movies. It's kind of a pop culture, one of the only pop culture references of the area when it comes to grape growing. Mostly known for Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, but what a lot of people don't know is it makes some exquisite and terroir-driven grown varieties, particularly Syrah.
Yeah, I saw that as a Syrah. I was a little surprised by it, but surprised by the vineyard as well. So that's quite a coup for you. Good for you.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, you know, I would think from what you've talked about in terms of your family, those are some of your greatest influences. But do you have influences as a winemaker?
Yeah, I would say that obviously Lisa and Wes gave me the fire. And then my dad really, although maybe he wasn't the kind of influence in that he gave me a lot of knowledge about winemaking, but experientially, him and I spent so much time together talking about wine and bouncing ideas off of each other. And he was really a support system. So in a way, you know, there's different kinds of influences and mentors, and my father is certainly one of them. And then from a professional standpoint, I spent some time working for Turley Wine Cellars in St. Helena, as well as here in Paso. And their winemaker here in Paso Robles, his name is Carl Wicca, and he was an immense inspiration and continues to be a support system for me to this day. And that organization at the time, Aaron Jorgen was the winemaker, and I got to speak with him a few times, and he was in his limited capacity that I got to interact with him, very influential, as well as Tegan Pasalagua. The time that I spent with him as well.
Wow, you've been a lucky guy.
Very lucky, yeah.
Yeah. So with that in mind, probably a tougher question in terms of, is there one central rule or lesson that you would say that you've learned as a winemaker?
I think it's easy, and you witness a lot of winemakers who want a lot of control over the winemaking process within the winery. There's a lot that you can do on the vineyard side to get the result you want. But there's so, like, outside of sanitation, there's so much work that goes into trying to manipulate the wine sometimes. And I think the one thing that I learned from the folks at Turley, as well as Francois Pichon, was a lot of the time you just need to let the wine in the winery do its own thing. So for that reason, I do a lot of natural ML fermentation. I don't inoculate with bacteria for secondary fermentation. And I, to me, believe that that creates a really rich diversity of biome within the wine during that secondary fermentation. And I think that's one thing that, in, you know, I'm young. I would definitely categorize myself as someone who's still learning. But that's one thing that I've seen, a very impressionable change in the way that the wine expresses itself. Once try to give up a little bit of control in the cellar and let the wines kind of take their own course in aging.
Sure, that's a good answer. About how many cases are you doing, by the way? I didn't think to ask you that.
We are doing about 600 cases a year.
From what I've seen, primarily red, or are you doing some whites as well?
We are doing a white. We do a Viognier, in which, for those lovers of Viognier or those knowledgeable of Viognier, it has a different texture than other white wines. It tends to be a little bit more weighty, oily in some way that I've heard it described before. And there's ways to kind of combat that. Some people use residual sugar. I'm not a big fan of residual sugar in wine. So instead, we sought out a high acid site on the west side of Paso in the Willow Creek District, which is known for a lot of acid retention in the grapes. And coupling acid retention in grapes with no oak and all stainless steel fermented and aged, found a way to make Viognier in its highly expressive aromatic style and flavor, but with this resounding amount of acidity that just balances the whole thing out.
Nice. Considering what we've just talked about, you know, I know a lot of winemakers like to, on the side, experiment a bit. And, you know, I've often kidded that winemakers are mad scientists. I'm not kidding. I really mean that. You know, have you had the opportunity to do anything kind of a little wacky and different?
Well, with Nenau Family Wines, I think there's a lot of people out there that will say that you don't get into owning a winery really to make money, especially not first off. So I don't do a whole lot of experimentation within Nenau Family Wines, but my job at Onyx affords me to do a lot of experimentation.
Cool.
You do all kinds of co-fermentations with varieties that you wouldn't typically see together, like Grenache and Tempranillo, Tempranillo and Malbec, Syrah and Viognier, which is a little bit more grounded in history. But in that job, I've done a lot of experimentation of blending, and that's where I've got to trial the natural malolactic fermentation concept that now is a mainstay in my winemaking protocol. And then a fair bit of yeast trials as well to really narrow in the kind of fermentation yeast that I really like to use.
So this is probably a loaded question because you may have already gone there, but and this is broad. This would be any spirits, but what do you like to drink? Anything?
Well, it just depends on the season. But I think as of late, the Côte de Rhones, they've had a couple of exceptional vintages that are on the market right now. And so anything Côte de Rhone is right in my alleyway right now. So I've been drinking a lot of French wines as of late. Paso is a region which, you know, it's arid and it was hit pretty hard by the drought and was making, you know, within drought and struggle comes really impressionable wines. But they're not necessarily old world in style at all. And that point being that now out of the drought, this region is starting to express itself in a totally different way with maintaining of acidity and less tannin and more translucent and just more complex, nuanced wines that remind me a lot more of old world wines. So I've been spending a lot of time and enjoying those wines because that's kind of the shift in the climate that I've seen around here.
Yeah, and the area has become so much more popular. You can say so many different areas other than the common areas of Napa are getting recognized, and rightly so, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the amount of traffic that we've seen coming into this area, it's more accessible than ever. I think people, you know, part of the reason of Napa's success is its proximity to the Bay Area, for sure. Not only, you know, that's not to discount the fantastic wine that's made there and the winemakers that are doing it and the grape growers that are growing grapes. But Paso is so much more accessible now from both the Bay Area and LA. I think a 3-hour drive doesn't sound as terrible to people anymore. the traffic has increased and the amount of investment going into growing grapes at a high quality and the number of wineries committed to making world-class wine is, maybe there was a handful in the 90s, and now there's a few dozen, if not more.
Well, if you're not willing to drive 3 hours for wine, you shouldn't be drinking wine, in my opinion.
Well said. Amen.
Thank you. So we had talked a bit before the interview. Every winemaker has had unique experiences in the cellar or in the vineyard. It can be dangerous work. It can be a lot of fun. As you mentioned at that time, every winemaker's had at least a few dozen, if not more, crazy experiences. Anything you can think of that comes to mind thinking like, wow, I'm glad I survived that, or, you know, that was a little bit silly.
Well, there was one where when I was first working at Onyx, we always do bulldog transfers of wines to try and preserve fresh aromatics and flavors, and the same goes for Nenow Family Wines. And this bulldog transfer, for those who don't know, is something where you displace the wine with inert gas in order to transfer it from one vessel to another. So when planning a transfer, I had a lot that was about 530 gallons, and the tank that it was going to was about 530 gallons. And what I didn't think of at the time was that when you get to the last barrel and you're transferring the last bit of wine into the tank, the wine will go in, but there's still this displaced gas that's following right behind the wine. And guess what? That has mass, that has technically volume, albeit not liquid. So what ensued was a geyser of wine out the top of the tank. And it was a very humbling moment in which I realized that there's mass to things other than liquid in that situation.
Yeah, those are the things you'll look back on, and I guess that'll probably always keep you humble as a winemaker, right?
And it gives you a nice perspective when you're teaching somebody how to work in the cellar, and you draw on those experiences and you tell those kinds of stories to enlist just a little bit of fear and maybe make them think a little bit more about what they're doing.
A little respect.
Yes. And all in all, it probably was 10 to 15 gallons lost, but it certainly was impressionable.
Gallons in a spilling fashion seem a lot bigger than they do in terms of bottles.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Many times I ask winemakers, what's become my favorite question is when you've been interviewed, when you've done press, what's the one question that you don't get asked that you would like to be asked? So I put this to you in kind of a different frame because you haven't done quite as many. You know, what would be that one thing you really enjoy talking about?
I think I really enjoy talking about the people that go into making the wine. I think a lot of the time the notion or feeling is that me holding the title as winemaker is that I'm the one out there doing all of the work. And that couldn't be farther from the truth. From watching my aunt and uncle, I love cellar work and I never am wanting to be removed from it. There are these very talented and very hardworking people in the cellars and in the vineyards that a lot of the time don't get talked about. So sometimes if I get interviewed, I wish that I would be asked more about who those people are that are making it happen from behind the scenes.
Well, maybe you could mention a couple of those people. That way we can get their names out there.
Absolutely. So at Onyx, I have an assistant winemaker. Her name is Lily McLaughlin, and she has a background in Pinot Noir and has this great palate for nuance and complexity, and within our program, she's invaluable for that kind of perspective. For me, who grew up making these heavy-hitting Cabernets and drinking these culty wines of the late 90s. And then we have an enologist, Lauren Fessenden, who, for someone only 2 years out of college, just has a real hunger for learning and is the kind of person that can work a 14-hour day, show back up the next morning and have just as much energy as she did the day before. And then within the vineyard, we have, I would speak to Nenow Family Wines more here with the growers that we work with. There's a man by the name of John Rolfe.
here in the area who does exquisite dry farming of Rhone varieties. And we've worked with him on a few varieties. There's Connor McMahon in Coastal Vineyard Care Services here in Paso that just does really amazing farming. The vineyard that they work off of and that we pull fruit from is called Full Draw. And just people who take a really hard work and do things a more difficult way because it is the better way.
I think it's interesting. You know, there are so many people behind the bottle, and you really are behind the curtain in so many ways. So with that in mind, people do look at winemakers in a godlike fashion, I have to say. And my impression is that probably makes you a bit uncomfortable, but, you know, how do you want people to see you? I'm sure you do plenty of tastings, so how do you want to be seen as a winemaker?
I want to be seen as approachable, just in the way that I think maybe the precedent that's been set, because wine often feels like this unattainable or something that is a little intimidating for people at times. I would want to be seen as somebody that you can talk to and learn about wine in the way that wine interests you. So definitely not, I make more mistakes than I care to admit. I'm definitely not a perfect human being. And at the end of the day, I'm just living my dream. All I want to do is make wine, and I get to do that. So I would love to be seen as somebody who could be approached, and I could share that passion with them.
We were talking about Syrah before, which is neat that you're doing it in that area. Give me a little bit of background on the Syrah that you're making there.
Well, we focus a lot on Syrah's ability to express itself wildly differently based off of where it's grown, you know, in the sense terroir. So we produce three different Syrahs that are all exactly the same clone. They're all Estrella clone Syrah, yet where they're produced, they express themselves so differently. We have a wine called 99 Steps that is our Westside Castleables Syrah. It's always produced in the Willow Creek district of Paso, which is known for your high acid retention. And we co-ferment it with a little bit of Viognier, and it takes on its own style of where it's grown. And then we spoke about the Bienesito Syrah, which is the prototypical terroir vineyard where you could take a dozen winemakers and make Syrah out of the block, and the undercurrent of the wine will be the same no matter what the winemaker did. And then thirdly, we work with a vineyard down in Ballard Canyon, also in St. Barbara County, by the name of Kinsey Vineyard. And it's the same thing. I worked with and talked to a half a dozen winemakers that I respect in the area, tasted their versions, iterations of Kinsey, and they all had the same undercurrent that was so obviously Ballard Canyon Kinsey Vineyard Syrah. So to be able to make the same grape in three totally different ways just because of where it's grown is something that's we really love, and that's why we do those single vineyard designate bottlings of those.
You have a lot of fun doing what you do, don't you?
Too much.
Never. No such thing. Drew, does Dino Family have a tasting room at this point, or...?
We are opening a tasting room next month by the third week of July. We will be open right up on Peachy Canyon Road on the west side of Paso. We're really excited about it, to have a storefront to be able to host people at.
Yeah, that'll be nice. Well, if our listeners would like to learn a little bit about you, how would they find out about you on the web? What is your website?
Our website is ninafamilywines.com. You can check us out. We have a bunch of bios about myself, my wife, my sister, and brother-in-law. And then also our winemaking philosophy is right there.
Excellent. Drew, this has been a lot of fun talking with you. Being you guys are sort of new to the business, I wish you nothing but a lot of luck.
Oh, thank you. And thanks for the chance to get on here. You've interviewed a lot of winemakers that I highly respect, and it feels good to be on here, too.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Learn more by visiting ninafamilywines.com.
Thanks for listening, and remember to like us on Facebook. Also, check out our YouTube channel.
Life Between the Vines is produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Theme song and original music written and recorded by Tim Dondarevo. Additional original music by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our graphics and website specialist is Lawton Hall. Our web geek is Dan Gieschen. Copyright 2020.